Today, I will be speaking to Bob Eccles, who is a leading authority on the integration of environmental, social, and governance, ESG factors, in resource allocation decisions by companies and investors, as well as one of the foremost experts on integrated thinking. Among other things, Bob has been a professor of management practice at the Harvard Business School, founding chairman of SASB, the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, as well as one of the founders of the IIRC, International Integrated Reporting Council. He's currently a professor at SAID Business School. We are honored to have him today to share his market-leading knowledge and his views on how companies and investors can create sustainable strategies in line with their purpose. Bob, welcome to the podcast. Really happy to have you with us today.
Thank you, Sally. Great to be here.
Super. Now, Bob, I just thought we could start by you sharing a little bit about your background and experience and your focus right now, if you could, to set the context for the conversation.
So, wow, I'm almost 70 years old, Sally, so there's a lot of background. I'll try to be crisp. So I've been a business school professor for most of my life at Harvard and now at Oxford. And there's a long shaggy dog story I won't get into, but basically my focus, the way I like to explain it, I'm a child of the 60s. I was an activist in the 60s. I had a beard. It wasn't gray. I had a ponytail, which I don't now because I don't have enough hair. But now I'm a capital market activist. And so my focus is really how can you leverage the capital markets to contribute to sustainable development, which means changing resource allocation decisions, both on the investor side and within the company side.
Okay, I like that. Now, as part of that, I'm sure communication plays a critical role. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you about is what you thought about the value that a company can derive from communicating to its investors and wider stakeholders.
So I think it's a fundamental question, and thank you for asking that. I started this journey of looking at corporate disclosures in so-called non-financial reporting some 35 years ago when it was lunatic fringe activity. And it's now gone somewhat mainstream in a variety of ways we can talk about. Clearly, we've gotten to the point now where investors recognize that how a company is managing material sustainability issues contributes to financial performance. The frontier is now how a company's products and services are having positive and negative impacts on the environment. And investors want to know this. Probably for 20 years, the corporate community was ahead of the investment community. They picked up on GR reporting, and kudos to the GRI for, I think, that just enormous work that they've done to generate sustainability reporting, and then other groups have gotten involved. And companies said, gee, we're reporting the sustainability information, investors don't care. And they were largely right. And then the switch flipped for a variety of reasons we can get into if you like. And so investors are now really expecting and demanding. I mean, sort of some good examples, BlackRock, as you know, and Larry Fink's most recent letter said they want all their portfolio companies to report according to the TCFD framework in SASB. And then I recently learned that State Street is asking for disclosures from companies on racial diversity, racial and ethnic diversity. So you've got kind of an environmental example being pushed by BlackRock and a social example by State Street. And they're the two of the three largest asset managers in the world. Companies are going to have to pay attention to them.
So do you think we've reached a tipping point then? I mean, you've mentioned a couple of the big asset owners, but do you think that generally investors are, there's momentum around this for mainstream investors, investors in bulk?
I think there is some kind of, we've reached the tipping point in terms of the mainstream investors. It's probably important to note the degree of concentration in the asset management industry. I wrote about this in my HBR article last year, so I probably don't remember the numbers exactly right. But something like the top five have 25% of assets under management, and the top 10 about a third. So you don't need that many asset managers to be asking for sustainability information, ideally, as we'll talk about in an integrated report, to make that mainstream. Certainly active investors recognize the importance of this. The pension funds, the asset owners, they want this information because they've got a very long-term view. I think one of the challenges to making this mainstream is that there is a plethora of reporting standards. There's, you know, GRI, which I mentioned. There's the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, which was started about 10 years ago. I think, you know, I was the founding chairman of that. There's CDP, there's CDSB, there's IRC, there's TCFD. And the good news on this front is there's the Impact Management Project, where the CEO is this wonderful, brilliant woman named Clara Barbie. And they have been working, IMP is a structured network, they've been working with those five standard-setting organizations that I've mentioned, as well as others, and just last week published their statement of intent towards developing a common and collaborative framework. And so if you could get those groups to come to an agreement on kind of common language and frameworks and standards, ideally match up with the EU, which is revising its non-financial reporting directive and is planning to mandate sustainability reporting, ideally, in my view, using standards developed by these private bodies so that we've got standards for so-called non-financial information that are the same degree of rigor and quality as financial information, where they have to be reported and they're subject to the same degree of assurance, positive assurance, a real audit, as we have with financial information. It's gone mainstream. That will then get to my goal of changing resource allocation decisions with inside companies, taking a longer-term view, as well as enabling investors to make changes in their own resource allocation decisions. But to do that, we need to have the sustainability data being integrated in the work that the portfolio managers do, not just, you know, with the ESG kind of group within the investor, just like we need the CFOs to feel as responsible for the non-financial performance of the company and being able to communicate non-financial information and its importance to financial results on the company side. And right now you still have kind of silos. You got the CFO silo and the sustainability silo, and the investor side, you've got the portfolio manager silo, and you've got the ESG steward group silo. We need to put those silos together.
I would absolutely agree with that. So that's really good progress and a big step in the right direction. So what do you think over the short term that means for corporates when trying to navigate their reporting to best meet the needs of investors?
So I think the first step for corporates is to take SASB as the initial guidance. Mm-hmm. SASB was developed for investors, so that's their audience. GRI was developed for multiple stakeholders. Their definition of materiality is different. For SASB, materiality is essentially information that would matter to an investor, as it is for the ISB, as it is for FASB. They have an 11-sector classification system, which subdivides into 77 industries, a materiality map, which is publicly available. On average, there's about 5 or 6 material issues for each one of these industries, and I think that's a good place to start. Companies don't necessarily have to take it as gospel, but I think it's good guidance. Investors are increasingly looking to that. So that's really the table stakes, and that gets to ESG integration. So that's the first step. Then the second step, and in some ways the frontier, is that companies need to think about how they would report on the externalities, positive and negative, being created by their operations, products, and services. That's really been the domain of the GRI. Their definition of materiality is not what matters to investors. Mm-hmm. It's basically what matters to the world. And investors, particularly the large universal owners, those concerned about system-level risk like climate change, like income inequality, they're clearly related. They want to get a sense of what the company's externalities are that are being created as well. We don't have as good guidance on measuring impact. It's more complicated. It requires data from outside the firm because impact is data that needs to be put in context. But if companies could start with good reporting on SASB, use the GRI as a guidance to think about the negative and positive externalities, and then ideally, as I said, this group that the Impact Management Project has pulled together in their structured network could come up with a kind of common framework for thinking about this. It will be enormously helpful to companies. It will be enormously helpful to investors and stakeholders and to the world.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Okay, we've dived really deep into reporting. And what I wanted to do is to take a step back, because when we've looked at reporting over the last 15 years in a lot of detail through our research, we've really been picking up on a number of themes beyond the tick boxing and the technical requirements of reporting that we really feel that companies need to address. And we call them our 6 principles of trust: purpose, culture, cognitive diversity, stakeholder engagement, responsible business, and the 6th one being transformational and long-term thinking. And we believe that individually and collectively, these principles contribute to corporate trust and will be critical to forging strong relationships in the future. And really, I think, I guess, bringing these to life, the spirit of these, I think, is what sort of needs to sit above all reporting in terms of how you communicate that story. So what I wanted to ask you about is, do our principles of trust resonate with you? And is there one in particular that you think is most important and why?
So I like your principles of trust. I wouldn't say that I think one is more important than the others, but you've kind of pitched a softball across the plate, Sally, as the vernacular would be here in the States. Mm-hmm. So let me pick up on the first one, which is purpose. Because I think in a lot of ways, reporting must begin with that. And you can probably get a sense of where I'm going with this. Purpose has become a common narrative now. And I think it started some with Larry Fink 3 or 4 years ago, and people were initially a little bit confused. I think the same year he came out with it, my colleague Colin Mayer wrote this wonderful book called Prosperity, Better Business Makes the Greater Good. And so there's all this talk about now companies having purpose. And there's some controversy around it. The Business Roundtable in August 19th of last year published their statement of the purpose of a corporation. And I was originally encouraged by that. In my last book on integrated reporting with a gentleman named Tim Yeomans, who's now at Federated Hermes EOS, we developed this idea of a statement of purpose, and we were like pushing a rock uphill. And I thought, this is great. Now that the Business Roundtable has acknowledged the importance of other stakeholders and taking a longer-term view, we can finally make traction on an idea that we've been pushing. I think a fairly simple one and an easy ask, which is that the board of directors of every listed company and as many private ones as possible publish a simple 1 or 2 or 3 page statement of purpose. We developed this idea in the context of my second book on integrated reporting I did with Mike Cruz. And the idea was that once the board has articulated the purpose of the company and who the stakeholders are, the key stakeholders and the trade-offs, that then gives guidance for management to think about materiality, to think about impact, and that guides their reporting. And we thought it really needed to begin with the board of directors because their duty isn't just to shareholders, their duty is to the corporation, and obviously they need to take shareholders into account. So it seemed like a natural starting point, and we just got an enormous amount of pushback for a variety of reasons. And that's why, you know, initially I was rather encouraged when the Business Roundtable came out with their statement. But to date, there's now, I guess there was an originally 181, there's some 220. Not a single one of these Business Roundtable companies, maybe I'm just not an effective salesman, not a single one of these companies have published a statement of purpose by their board of directors. And so I'm becoming somewhat cynical in this regard. There's studies that have been done showing that the Business Roundtable companies don't perform any better, in fact, in some ways worse than a matched set of companies. I'm involved in a project. The data is going to come out next week, which is going to verify that. Lucian Bebchuk at Harvard Law School with his colleague Roberto Tallarita did this, you know, nice paper, The Illusory Promise of Stakeholder Capitalism, which I don't necessarily agree with the paper, but they did a survey of the Business Roundtable companies to ask if the CEOs had gone to their board to sign off on the statement. If it's such a big deal, they made a big deal out of it. 1997 was our last statement on corporate governance. Of the ones that responded, only one did. So I'm sitting here scratching my head saying, well, if this is such a big deal, why did the CEO not go to the board? They say, here again, I'm being cynical, oh, we didn't have to go to the board. We've been doing purpose for years. So this was like an easy thing to sign. I think this is disingenuous. I think until companies start publishing a statement of purpose signed by the board of directors whose duty is to the corporation, use that as a foundation then for integrated reporting to explain how they're accomplishing their purpose. Until we get to that point, I think it's all just happy talk. So I'm delighted that purpose is, you know, one of your guidelines for how companies establish trust.
What I wanted to dig a bit deeper on, because I agree with your sort of skepticism over this and frustration, and is that, I suspect, one of the main drivers behind the new initiative that you've been involved with, Enacting Purpose Initiative, which I know has just come out with your first report, called Enacting Purpose Within Modern Corporation, a framework for board of directors. And I thought the report was excellent. And I think what was, I think, particularly interesting about it was clearly the focus on providing guidance to boards of directors, where I don't think there's much practical guidance out there. Can you share with us a little bit more about the initiative and what you're trying to achieve with this?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So this was originally started at Said Business School at Oxford University, and we've got some strategic partners, the University of California, Berkeley Law School with Professor Amelia Miazad. The British Academy has been involved pretty much from the beginning. We've got Federated Hermes EOS, as I've mentioned. BCG is involved now with both in general and with Bright House. And so we came out, the original report that you referred to was based on a European steering group of 25 or 30 company board directors that was led by my colleague Rupert Younger. It was Rupert and Colin, whose book I mentioned, and I that kind of got this thing started. And we published our report, I guess it was a month ago, and you mentioned the framework, and again, credit to Rupert for developing this framework. It's a simple framework score. We're saying that, you know, for enacting purpose, boards of directors, you know, you need to simplify, you need to connect, own, reward, and exemplify, and the report gets into those. And, you know, it's gratifying to see that boards have found this, you know, a useful way of thinking about it. That report has been published, and now our focus is, because that was the European steering group, we're in the process of forming a North American steering group, so the counterpart to the European steering group, again, of company board directors. But we're also forming an investor steering group, collaborating with my friend Ann Simpson on that, who's the director of governance and strategy at CalPERS, because we want to get investor input. And obviously, the investor group will be a global one. And what we plan to do is replicate the process that we did in Europe. We'll have three meetings. We'll get input from company board directors here in the US and Canada. And we'll also have our investor steering group. We'll combine the insights we get there, because there are some nuances around corporate governance in the United States compared to Europe. And we plan to publish a report in the first half of next year. And then the next step after that is Asia. So what we're really trying to do is develop tools, frameworks, guidelines to enable boards of directors, senior management to articulate and then enact purpose so that it becomes authentic and not just kind of the happy talk that, you know, unfortunately we're seeing too much of today.
Okay, and that's what I wanted to share a little bit about, because one of the things that really struck me in your report is the distinction that you make between purpose as strategy, central within decision making, and can be used as a powerful frame to guide the organization, versus what is referred to more commonly, I think, is purpose on culture. And we see this reflection in our research on reporting as well. Although the majority of companies set out a purpose in their annual report in the FTSE 100, and many of them go beyond creating shareholder value, the challenge that we found was that there was a very tenuous link between purpose and strategy. And I would suggest that more companies really look at purpose as culture rather than as this link to strategy. Could you elaborate a little bit more on this distinction in thinking about purpose and what we've seen in reporting? Is that fair to, similar to what you're seeing in your discussions?
Yes, I mean, we are seeing that in kind of the, what you describe isn't surprising to me. I think to some extent it goes back to the silos that I was talking about earlier, that originally, purpose would have been in the domain of philanthropy, if you sort of go back far enough. So, you know, we're a nice company and, you know, we give some money to community organizations and give our employees, you know, a day a week off to go do something. You can clearly hear my cynical tone. And I'm not opposed to philanthropy, but this was kind of, this was the sustainability people, it was the HR people. And so purpose was kind of in that context. And not surprisingly, it sort of became part of culture. Purpose wasn't something that, you know, was done by the strategy person, the CFO, the CEO. And so if you're going to make sort of purpose a strategy, then one way it gets reflected and very, very clearly is in capital allocation. You know, what do you spend money on? What do you not spend money on? What choices are you making? And how are you making those choices in the context of what, you know, your stakeholders expect and how those are going to contribute? or get in the way of you accomplishing, you know, your ability to create value over the long term. So I think to get to purpose to strategy, you've got to get it over to, you know, the financial part, to the capital allocation part. And that's why I think integrated reporting is important, because it pulls both of those things together. And Sally, I know you've been involved, you know, with the integrated reporting movement from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And one of the things, I mean, in some senses, in reporting, we are seeing when companies are reporting on purpose, it's, as you said, it's not very authentic and it's not very embedded. From our research, we also have similar feelings of not really getting the sense that purpose is authentic in companies, really embedded in companies and really being used to drive strategic decision making. So, Bob, could you share with us a little bit more about the statement of intent that you were suggesting and what the benefits of that could be for corporations?
So, if we're going to contrast purpose with kind of mission, vision, and values, I think when you look at companies, and they're often, the terms are confused and used interchangeably, for most companies, you can find a mission statement or a vision statement. And again, those get confused and they talk about their values. But these are things that are kind of in a report, they're floating on the website, to whom no one is accountable. It's just a statement that's out there in the world. And when I think about a statement of purpose, who's accountable for the statement of purpose is the board of directors. And that's why I think it's important. That's what I think the big difference is when the board of directors puts its name to a statement of purpose and it has the elements that I referred to before, I think two characteristics that are important is it has to be stakeholder inclusive. If a company really believes about purpose, it needs to be very company specific and it needs to be unique. So when you look at mission and vision statements, they're interchangeable. I mean, it could be almost any company or it could be sort of any company in a particular sector, the way it's described. A good statement of purpose, and I must admit there's not many examples, I can give you a few if you want, but a good statement of purpose will be very distinctly about that company. You read that statement of purpose and you'll know that it's, you know, XYZ company, not one of their major competitors. And I think that level of accountability, when the board has given its view on the role of the corporation in society, that then becomes the basis for engagement by shareholders and by other stakeholders to say, well, you know, thank you very much. I'm not clear about this. I don't know how you're handling trade-offs on this. How do I know if you're accomplishing purpose? How do you know if you're accomplishing purpose? And then that's where integrated reporting comes in. So I really think that the statement of purpose, the way I describe it, I think it's catalytic, but it's not a silver bullet. It's a necessary first step. With Leo Strein and Tim, we wrote a little piece in the Harvard Business Review, Three Ways to Put Your Corporate Purpose into Action. First step, statement of purpose by the board. Second step, an integrated report. And then if you really mean it, in a U.S. context, you know, you can move, and I know this is controversial for any U.S. listeners, you will move to become a Delaware public benefit corporation, where Leo Strein, who was the retired Chief Justice of the Delaware Supreme Court. So if anybody knows about corporate governance in America, it's Leo Strein. He makes a nice distinction between, in a Delaware C-Corp in U.S. language, the board of directors may take other stakeholders' interests into account if they can, you know, make the argument and have a rationale, which they can easily do under the business judgment rule, that these stakeholder interests are important for long-term value creation too. In a Delaware public benefit corporation, they shall. So there's a specific positive duty that the company has to whatever the environmental and social issues are that they say that they are addressing. And the board of directors is held accountable to that by the shareholders. And if you look at, I mean, going back to Colin's book, the corporate form we have today of corporations focused on shareholders, all the Milton Friedman ideology, which, you know, went all through this last week, that's a relatively, you know, modern construction. Corporations haven't been that way for most of history. And there's no reason to think that the corporate form that we've had for the past 50 or 60 years is fit for purpose going forward, particularly in a world where there's such huge concentration of assets in a relatively small number of companies, relatively small number of asset managers, and where the aggregate effect of companies' activities is creating sort of system-level risk, climate change, resource scarcity, I believe that until we sort of change the basic form of the corporation so that companies, you know, don't think and the laws aren't that you just serve shareholders, even though the laws don't say that, I don't think we're going to get where we need to be. And just like it's hard to get a statement of purpose, it's hard to get an integrated report, it's probably even harder to get a corporation to become a Delaware public benefit corporation. So what you need to find is companies that will be leaders out there. And again, the cynic in me says, oh, I go to these companies and everybody says they want a leader, but nobody wants to go first. They're all waiting for somebody else to go first. Drives me nuts.
I would agree with that. So how do we get this on the agenda? Because, I mean, that's what I think we struggle with as well. I mean, the theory, the research is all there, the academic studies, all the thinking. But how do we actually get corporates to embrace this? Can you share in your experience, what are the most effective conversations or salient points that you've made that actually make people sit up and listen?
So, good question. I think that, you know, work like the Enacting Purpose Initiative is doing that develop frameworks that's based on input from groups they find credible, like their peers who are company chairs and lead independent directors. I think that's useful. I think the investor pressure is useful to the extent that investors, particularly the portfolio managers that are engaging with the CFOs and CEOs, they're saying, we want to know your purpose. They're saying, what do you think of the material issues? What are the impacts you're having? How do you measure and report on that? They have to pay attention to their investors. And then I think it's always good to have examples of someone that's gone first. And I can give you, I'm sure it's controversial, an example of a U.S. company, the only U.S. company that's published a statement of purpose. It's Philip Morris International. It's a tobacco company. Full disclosure, they're a client of mine. Some people find that controversial. They have a commitment to a smoke-free world. They are a Virginia C Corp. Their board of directors published a statement of purpose in their 2020 proxy statement, which is about as official filing document as you can get in the United States. A few months later, they produced an integrated report, which is excellent, compares to the best integrated report you'd find anywhere in the world. No U.S. company is producing an integrated report that's of close to the same quality. And I'm thinking, okay, so they're in a controversial industry. I understand that. Their purpose, they've made this commitment to a smoke-free world. They're going to be held accountable for it. Their board has taken that position. There's an integrated report. If Philip Morris International, that's subject to the same security laws as every other company in the United States, can put these into practice, then any other U.S. company can as well. As well can any other company in the world.
Yeah, great example. So could you share a little bit more about some of the challenges they may have had in coming up with that statement and also some of the benefits?
So as you can imagine, I mean, when you talk about trust, I mean, trust in the cigarette industry and the tobacco industry is as low as it deserves to be for, you know, decades of dissembling and misinformation and lack of transparency. So they've got a big trust hole to dig out of. They had made this commitment. The core to it was they developed a product, I won't get into this, called IQOS, which is a reduced risk product, which heats and doesn't burn the tobacco. So a key to their transformation was that they developed an alternative to cigarettes, which is not, you know, risk-free, but it's much less risky. Then they said, okay, we've got a better alternative. People are addicted to nicotine. They're very clear. You're better off not to smoke at all. Quit if you can. But if you can't, this is a better alternative. So that took them 20 years. I'd imagine it's like an oil and gas company would sort of invest enough money so that they could completely, you know, make a credible case to get out of the oil business. So $6 or $7 billion later, 20 years later, they finally got it right. They had two failed launches. They finally got a product. Then they had a product that could replace cigarettes. Then they made a commitment. And in their 2017 proxy statement, there was essentially, without it being named this way, the board of directors wrote a letter to shareholders saying, you know, this is our commitment to a smoke-free future. Then the groundwork had been laid, and so the board has been very supportive. They then published, you know, their statement of purpose. They clearly knew about the idea. I started working with them. And they realized that, you know, this would particularly for them, people are going to be cynical. I understand that. You know, they, to be credible, to be authentic, they've got to provide information. Now, you still have NGOs who don't want to talk to them and investors who exclude, and I kind of get all that. But they, in their integrated report, they have aspirational targets, they call them, for their business transformation metrics. A good example is that by 2025, 38 to 42% of their revenues will come from these reduced risk products. Imagine an oil and gas company saying 5 years from now, you know, 38 to 42% of our revenues are going to come from renewable energy. So when a company makes that kind of public commitment and it's in the public domain, you can expect that they think they're going to be held accountable for it. And so they're reorganizing their processes and their compensation. And so there's this huge effort going on to deliver on a rather dramatic commitment that they've made, but reporting is really going to be key to it. So you needed the board of directors to step up, which they did. Then you need to have the integrated report, which they do. And the board was very supportive. The CEO was very supportive. It was under Hoop Savakuls, who's the chief sustainability officer, Jennifer Modals, who's the director of social impact and sustainability. And they had great collaboration between the sustainability group and the finance group to get to where they are today. But it, you know, nothing's easy, right?
No, nothing's easy. But in a sense, I guess that's what we see every day, that the process of reporting can be very beneficial and used as a tool by companies to, as you said, you know, set targets, stimulate debate, align thinking, and actually deliver on things, which I think is very powerful to demonstrate accountability to the marketplace. So that, I mean, that's a really, really good example. So we need more.
Well, I can give you another example. Yeah. I mean, there's a wonderful firm called EQT.
Yeah.
Shows that, you know, statement of purpose isn't just good for U.S. tobacco companies. There's a wonderful company called EQT. It's a Stockholm-based private equity firm. It's listed as of last fall. And they included a statement of purpose in their annual report, their 2019 annual report. And I've written an article on EQT called EQT Private Equity with a Purpose with two people there, Therese Lenahog, who's the head of sustainability, and Nina Nornholm, who's the head of communications. And so, yes, there's a threat and a question about the license to operate for tobacco companies, but the same thing is true for private equity companies. I mean, you know, it's not nearly as controversial, obviously, but there's some big questions. And what's striking to me about EQT is that they have integrated sustainability and impact throughout every one of their portfolio companies. So what you mostly see is big private equity firms creating a separate impact fund. And I'm not opposed to that, but I don't think that's nearly as important as making ESG metrics, reporting, compensation, impact through the lens of the SDGs throughout all of your portfolio companies. And what they've done in their statement of purpose, and they have an integrated report, they've committed to that. So I look at EQT and I say, well, okay, they are the gold standard for me for what a private equity firm should be. So I think you can leverage, you know, what PMI has done. It's a controversial example of they can do it, other people can do it. What I'd like to see in the private equity industry through what EQT is doing, that basically, you know, every private equity firm work as hard as they can to adopt those practices, because this is a big deal. I mean, mostly integrated reporting has been, as we know, in kind of public companies, but you've got so much assets right now. There's what, $1.4 trillion in dry powder, the term that the people like to use in this industry. There's so many assets now in private equity that basically you're in kind of a black hole from a disclosure point of view, that these are creating, you know, system level risks, just like in public equities, on the same issues, climate change, income inequality. So I think, you know, we need to press the private equity industry, starting with the GPs. They need to be clear about their purpose. And ideally, what I'd like to see out of private equity is that I get it that they're private companies, but I don't see any reason why we couldn't have at least sustainability reporting from the portfolio companies. And I think that would make an enormous difference as well.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Now, throughout that, you mentioned a lot of terms. And one of the things that we know working with many corporates in many different sectors is there's a lot of terminology out there. There's purpose, there's ESG, sustainability, responsibility, impact, SDGs, you know, plus all the alphabet soup in terms of frameworks and standards. And it's quite confusing often for corporates to understand what the similarities or the differences are in all of this. In very simple terms, can you explain to me how you see all these things fitting together? You know, the main ones, sort of ESG, sustainability, responsibility, impact. How does that agenda all fit together? Is it all the same thing or parts of the same thing, or how would you describe it?
You know, it's a good question, and it's always hard to kind of enforce a universal definition of a terminology. I mean, I'm not the Oxford English Dictionary by any means, right? So I'd say purpose and responsibility, you can kind of fuse those together. Purpose is, you know, why does a company exist in simple terms? I mean, that's the way Colin describes it. You know, what is the role of that corporation in society? It's not to just make money for shareholders. It's to, you know, provide products and services that, you know, solve people's problems. So a responsible company is a purposeful company. I think, you know, ESG, environmental, social, and governance, that really has to do with how a company is managing itself, its operations. And so I think, again, SASB is a good guide for that and, you know, what the material issues are. Impact is different than ESG. Impact would be the positive and negative externalities of the products and services, and companies are increasingly looking at that through the lens of the SDGs. So if you had to say, what are the core terms that companies need to understand and investors who engage with them? There's purpose from the board of directors. There's the material issues that matter to shareholder value creation, which should be understood and reported on. There's the impact in the world that the company is having, both positive and negative. And then there's the role of reporting. And I think it's also important probably to understand the sustainable development goals. And if you have that, you've got the basics.
Okay, that's helpful. That's really helpful. So what I wanted to ask you next is sort of moving forward beyond the next horizon, just to end off with some practical advice and ideas for our audience. What do you think will be the top 4 or 5 things on the investor agenda when engaging with companies over the next 5 years?
Top 4 or 5 things from the point of view of investors? Good question. I think investors will want to know that the company has a clear view on what the material issues are through the SASB lens. Mm-hmm. I think investors will want to have a clear view of, does the company admit and recognize, and is it dealing with the negative externalities? And is it thinking about how it can produce positive externalities? I think you'll see, regardless of sector, the investment community increasingly interested in what a company is doing with respect to climate change. And that's where the TCFD reporting is coming in. I think that the whole COVID-19 crisis has illuminated social issues that people have recognized that probably haven't been dealt with as much. And so income inequality, racial inequality, I think those are going to be top issues. And I think just kind of better reporting and disclosure from companies. And I think the investment community is also hoping, as I said, that there will be some harmonization and convergence in standards to make this reporting simpler and more easily understood by everybody.
Yeah, that would be very welcome. Now, do you think there are any issues that will be on the investor agenda that, I mean, all of those things that you talked about, I think they're on the wider stakeholder agendas as well, in terms of regulators and employees and wider stakeholders. Is there anything else that we think we've missed off that list of what corporates need to be thinking about?
Well, I think, you know, those would be, so those things that I talked about, investors, I think corporates, you know, need to be thinking about, but I think, and I'll come back to another thing on investors, but I think investors are going to be the recipients of the information that's provided by companies. And it sort of reminds me of when I first got involved with integrated reporting and I was making the pitch, a company would say, well, gee, Bob, if I produce an integrated report, is my stock price going to go up? And I thought, you know, that's like one of those most stupid questions I've ever heard. That's like saying, gee, Bob, If I publish my financial statements, is my stock price going to go up? And oh, by the way, companies didn't have to publish their financial statements, even if they were listed in the United States, until the SEC was formed. So I don't know. Maybe it's going to go down because there's more transparency that your performance on, you know, sustainability issues that matter to value creation isn't very good. So on the company side, they're the reporter. I always love this. The accountants say, reporters. That's how they refer to companies. It's reporters. It reminds me of the joke. Sorry, this is a detour. Do you know why civilians exist from the perspective of the U.S. Marine Corps? Why do civilians exist?
I don't know.
So that the Marines can protect them. And sometimes I think that, accountants think companies exist so that they can prepare financial statements, right? They're the preparers. They're the citizens. They're the preparers. Anyway, I diverge. I think what companies need to do is they need to think about all their practices that are going to lead to what their integrated report is going to look like. So, you know, how are they dealing with climate? How are they dealing with their employees? What are they doing in terms of recruiting and promotion and investment, compensation and gender pay equality? So there's a number of things that companies need to do, and particularly companies and industries where there's some substantial transformation that needs to take place. They need to think very fundamentally about, you know, what these processes and practices are connected to strategy and capital allocation, so that when they're doing this reporting, it's going to be sort of positive performance that they're talking about, not negative performance. Going back on investors, I think, and this was a little bit disheartening, I'm working on something called, and this will come out next week, COVID-19 and Inequality, A Test of Corporate Purpose, where what we've done is analyze, we did a survey with GlobeScan of 561 stakeholders, and then a study of the S&P 500 and the Euro Stoxx 300 to see how companies have responded during COVID-19. We've got an advisory board that I co-chair with Hiro Mizuno, who was the CEO of GPIF, and Sasha Sadan, who's the director of corporate governance and a board member at LGIM there in London. And we were talking about the Department of Labor guidance. And one of the points that Hiro made was, you know, that's like starting to have some impact in Japan. And so I think this is just nuts. I mean, I don't know the extent to which you followed this, but the Department of Labor is coming out with guidance to essentially try and thwart ESG investing in the United States. So you've got this divergence going on between the United States and the EU. We've got this nutcase president and this sort of whole ideological, you know, trapping that's been put on by, you know, the SEC, you know, Commissioner Hester Peirce, where they're all confounding, you know, sustainability with philanthropy. And you've got the Department of Labor comes out with this guidance, which makes no sense, while the EU is moving in the opposite direction. 30 days for comments to be put in. It's typically 90 days. So they clearly don't care what anybody has to say. They're going to issue their guidance that's going to be contrary to what needs to be done. All kinds of big asset owners and asset managers have written in saying this doesn't make any sense. And so one of the things we need to grapple with, and obviously this is more of a U.S. problem than a European problem, is government regulation matters. So you have the EU developing the taxonomy. You can, you know, argue about whether that's really going to shift capital or not. They're trying to come up with standards for non-financial information. And you've got the largest capital market in the world, you know, going in the wrong direction because of, as I said, you know, just this irrational presidency that we've got, which still takes my breath away every day. And that we're going to pay a price for. And the world is going to pay a price for, because what you need to get is these practices that we've been talking about all over the world. And when you've got a major U.S. regulator, like the Department of Labor, like the SEC, that is pushing in the wrong direction, that's not helpful. And that's where you need companies and where you need investors to be exercising their voice, saying, actually, this regulation, this proposed legislation doesn't make any sense, and we want it to go the other way.
Wow. Okay. No, I would agree with that. Now, just in this era of wider accountability, stakeholder engagement, and this changing kind of landscape, what I wanted to hone in on is, how do you think communications needs to change? We've talked a lot about reporting, and reporting, I guess, is one aspect of communications. But do you have any thoughts on sort of broader communications and what that means?
So this is probably above my pay grade. Could you explain a little bit more about broader communications beyond reporting? What do you mean by that?
What I mean by broader communications is reporting is one vehicle that companies use to demonstrate accountability and transparency to the marketplace, right? But it's not the only vehicle. It's the main vehicle really for demonstrating that with investors. But then they also have a lot of communication with their employees and their customers and all their different stakeholders. Do you have any views on how that communication needs to change or should change moving forward?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, I think again, it's going to sound like I'm a one-trick pony on the reporting, but I think communications with employees, with customers, with other stakeholders, if it's only words about positive things, then it's just not authentic to me. I think whoever you're communicating to, where there's problems, where there's challenges, where there's controversies, you need to acknowledge those. So, no offense to the PR people, but every company isn't always just 100%. You need to acknowledge when there's problems. I think, when you say positive things, they're going to be more accepted when you also recognize that there's negative things. I think you need to make commitments as to what you plan to do. So here's where we're at today. Here's where we want to be tomorrow, whether it's an environmental issue or a social issue or a product development issue. You need to make commitments. And then you need to provide information on the extent to which you're making those commitments or not. Because in the end, having commitments that you can put numbers to and you can report on those, that's the only way that, whoever the stakeholder is, shareholders, employees, customers, suppliers, that's the only way you can really know if they mean it or not, right?
Yeah, no, I would agree with it. And we often call it the authenticity challenge for companies, where we tell them that, you can't say one thing to one set of stakeholders and a different thing to another set of stakeholders. You have to have a consistent and coherent joined up message across all those things, which I think is really important.
How many companies? I mean, I completely agree with you. How many companies do you think are doing that today?
Communicating consistently to all their different stakeholders,
Yeah.
not that many. That's what we're trying to help with.
No, and I'm glad you are. I mean, it's a huge
Yeah, and
challenge.
it goes back to your siloed nature of business thing, though, doesn't it? Right? And I think that's why if you have something like a strong purpose that, provides that North Star for organizations, then everything can kind of fit underneath. But often what happens is stuff is sort of created from the bottom up almost to fit into the.
And you know who I think a big part of the problem is, while we're throwing stones at people?
Yeah.
I think it's the bloody lawyers, to tell you the truth.
Oh, probably in the US more so, yes. But yes, I would agree with
More so in the US, agree, because it's like, okay, my gosh, we can't say that. We're going to get sued. It's like, well, no, you're probably going to get sued if you don't say this stuff. So it's like, okay, we've got to be really scripted in the stuff that we say to investors and what we're putting in the, 10K and blah, blah, blah.
But that, you know what, that Bob, that's a really good point, because that's the beauty of the annual report is it has to be signed off, right? It's signed off by the lawyers, it's audited, all the rest of it. A lot of the other communications that a company does is not, it doesn't go through the same rigorous approvals process. So it doesn't have the same level of accountability, and it does tend to focus on the good news and not so much the bad news. So that's what
And it's making people cynical, particularly when companies are talking about purpose, and then they're clearly not enacting it.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what we, so reporting is a big thing, but we also need to make sure that we broaden it out to all of communication that a corporate does to its different stakeholders. That's what we're trying to do anyway, and use the opportunity and the process of reporting to make companies aware of that more. So, okay, last question. Beyond the next horizon, Bob, you said you're almost 70. You've been at this for many, many, many years. So, in 10 years' time, how would you like the conversation to have changed?
Well, speaking personally, in 10 years' time, hopefully sooner than that, I want to reach my personal goal of 400 pounds on the deadlift, and I'm only 5 pounds away. So, Sally, my most immediate goal, and I'm using the Magnuson-Ortmeyer routine to sort of get me there in a very disciplined way, I'd like to get to 400 pounds. But if I'm still paying attention to the world once I'm on the senior deadlifting professional circuit 10 years from now, what would I like to see?
Yes.
I would like to see, by 2025, every listed company's board publishing a statement of purpose. I would like to see integrated reporting become universal, required by regulation. I would like to see a common set of standards for sustainability or non-financial information, as I discussed before, through the work of the Impact Management Project, and that they have the same level of credibility and they have the same reliability and the same degree of rigor in the audit that you get for financial information. I'd like to see a rigorous way of measuring impact, the positive and negative externalities of a company's products and services. There's two groups I should have mentioned before. There's a very interesting project going on at Harvard under my colleague and friend George Serafim that Ronnie Cohen is funding, the Impact Weighted Accounts Initiative. I think that's really important work from the impact side, being complemented by a group called the Value Balancing Alliance, which is a group of companies that are working on creating, you know, impact measures, and they coordinate with the Impact Weighted Accounts Initiative. I think that would be an enormous breakthrough because it would get us to the sort of system level. And I would like to see sort of somehow global regulation, even if it's territory by territory, that has the same degree of kind of seriousness and rigor around non-financial and sustainability, whatever language you want to use, that we have for the financial issues in the capital markets today. And I think if we could get to that point, I think the world would be a better place. I think there's some chance of getting there. And it sure would help if the United States got a new president this year, I have to say.
Okay. Here's hoping that we get there and then we can both retire, right?
We can both retire. I'm going to deadlift. What are you going to do, Sally?
I'm going to surf. That's what I'm going to do.
Oh, you're going to surf. Good for you.
There we go. Yeah. No, not proper surfing. Stand up. Paddle surfing.
That's okay. What I'll do. I couldn't do one, so that's still good.
Yeah. Good. Well, that's super, Bob. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sally.